Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Åke Jens, senior researcher, the Arnold Bergstrasser Institute Freiburg. We're discussing selective security in the war on drugs, the coloniality of state power in Colombia and Mexico. This book examines the war on drugs in two particular contexts, with an eye to the security apparatus and dissenters against the escalation of conflict. Åke, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, you know, this book, I think it deals with a topic that I think is on a lot of people's minds, especially, you know, the war on drugs and just the general conflicts in Central America and in Mexico are constantly being drummed up in the American news media. And there's a lot of misinformation constantly swirling about. So I think, you know, these types of works, you know, and I know you've been working on this since 2010, this project. So, you know, you clearly come at it with a very deep and thoughtful perspective. And I think provide a lot of important historical background that a lot of people might not know and understand about the politics of countries south of America. So I think it's valuable for those listeners. But before getting into the book, I just wonder if you could tell us a little about yourself and your background.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. So I'm a political scientist. I studied political science and then did my PhD in sociology. So this sort of makes me an interdisciplinary scholar, pretty much from the start. And I've worked on and in Colombia and Mexico, and more recently in Costa Rica, and with colleagues from these places for more or less like 15 years now. And I've always been interested in how people become politically active in adverse circumstances. So I've worked on the connection between state and violence and neoliberalization policies and how people sort of react to that maybe, and on narratives of crime, and recently on how large-scale infrastructure projects reshape political agency and potentially also produce insecurity, not always, but yeah. And I'm responsible for the research cluster Contested Governance here at the Institute, and I also teach at Freiburg University.
So for this particular book, can you talk about how you kind of came to write it? What were the initial bits of research you did, or things that happened that kind of helped you crystallize this work?
Yeah, so I first came to Colombia as a student, pretty much a naive student of political science. And I got the chance to work with a human rights organization in Bogota in 2005, so quite some time ago. And I learned a lot from these people. This was at the height of the Colombian war on drugs, at least in its in the iteration of the 2000s. And sort of these things sort of stayed with me. And I then got the chance to write a PhD thesis and this topic of what the state actually does in these circumstances and how people are able to navigate these policies or state practices. That was a question that sort of stuck with me. And at the time when I started my PhD, Mexico was also becoming more present in media coverage because of escalating homicide rates. And so I was able to then start a project that would look at the two contexts and not through a classical comparison, but reading those two contexts sort of alongside each other. So not the classical political science approach, really. But I felt really uncomfortable with the existing analysis that seemed to see the effects of the so-called war on drugs as extreme anomalies, that also saw the role of organized crime as a dark counterpart to the state. So it didn't really rhyme with what I was seeing. So I wanted to go beyond these kind of narratives that I was reading.
At the most basic level, could you explain, you know, what the war on drugs is, this kind of term? I think the war on drugs, it means different things in different contexts. So how does it manifest in Mexico and Colombia?
So the so-called war on drugs is obviously not a new story, and lots of great scholars have written on this. Different instances of this war have gone on, and in different contexts it's different. So what the war on drugs looks like in the 2000s where I work on is a bit different from the images we see now on media platforms, like, for example, from El Salvador, where we see these punitive policies concert with the Mara groups and so on. But it's there's also like different iterations in the early 20th century already, or in mid-20th century, right? What I see is that in the early 2000s and 2002 in Colombia, for example, when President Uribe takes office, days after, he declares so-called rehabilitation zones. And it's sort of the idea is, or that's what's presented, is to regain control from criminal organizations in some areas that are particularly conflictual. And so to do this, the state needed exceptional preventive arrests, wiretaps, and restricted inhabitants' freedom of movement. And at the same time, these coercive practices were complemented by efforts to strike a relationship in areas where the state had not been present as more than occasional military operations, let's say, or at least there was a lack of social institutions, let's say. So, but that still was a purely military program. So we can see that, for example, in the media from that time, you would see reports like on the region of Arauca, which is in the east of Colombia, and this newspaper Semana, which was then widely read, would say, and I quote, "Every Thursday, groups of 20 children go to the battalion to play with the soldiers. They swim in the pool, participate in raffles, and take a ride in the Cascabel tank." So you can see that in these efforts, this is clearly counterinsurgency practices. So an effort to get people on the state side, and the ones that are fought officially are criminal groups. In this case, it's the guerrilla groups that were said to be involved in drug trafficking and so on. But at the same time, when we look at this a little bit closer, we can hear grassroots activists, for example, that would tell stories of harassment, arrests, killings. I went to Saravena in Arauca in 2009, and there was a gathering of social organizations, and the indigenous guard had the task of making this a safe space and preventing police or soldiers from entering the building. And they were in a permanent state of alert. And these people insisted that only a few years prior, in the early 2000s, the army had entered such towns like Saravena with paramilitaries in tow. And the military had allowed killings by those groups. So this is, you know, the war on drugs looks different in different contexts, but it also looks different according to whom we listen to. So that's a bit what I wanted to carve out, that there is sort of an official discourse about this, but there is much more to that. And others have done that as well, obviously, but I look at sort of the particular practices that are involved in this. And in Mexico, we have quite a similar thing going on. Mere days after taking office in 2006, then President Felipe Calderón announced a military-led operation. It was called Operativo Conjunto. So these were joint operations by different security bodies, let's say. And this was against crime. And similar to the Colombian rehabilitation zones, which were later then declared unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court, this there was not really a legal basis to what the SET was doing, right? So in the process, then the executive would also, with the coalitions that they had in both contexts, try to change the legal, the laws concerning the competencies of the military, for example, and of the police, and like the penal code and so on.
Looking at the kind of the deeper history of this lead up to this drug war, these sorts of increasing securitization, can you talk about the legacy of colonialism and some of the ways in which this helps explain the conditions that have led to the particular drug war that we see?
Yeah, of course. So the backstory to this is complex, right? So neither the so-called war nor the illegal economy in Mexico or Colombia or elsewhere are a local problem. You can't really understand them without the transnational connections and the demand that is elsewhere. I mean, this, I think, that's common sense, I think, by now. What we can see is, I would say, that there is still somewhat an economic dependency of these places. So there's specific economic relations that some places have, and these differ also within these countries, with other places in global economy. But there's also a vulnerability of specific social groups that are less able to influence state policies, and that are particularly targeted by punitive policies. I'm not the only one who's saying this, obviously. One of the classics that I build on is Aníbal Quijano, the Peruvian sociologist. He would say that this is the coloniality of state power, not colonialism itself, but the political power relations carried from colonial to contemporary times based on the categorization of people into groups during colonialism, like basically racialization. And this is a categorization that legitimized the economic relations during colonial times, but Quijano and around him, a whole school of thought, say they continue to shape what the social relations around the institutional scaffolding of the state looked like. And that does not explain the drug war as such, but it sheds some light on why some people are more affected by its punitive side. So, for example, how the so-called war on drugs increasingly intersected with military operations against the Zapatista communities in Chiapas, which was, of course, these operations existed before, but then during the 2000s, this turned into something else. And it's also something that I would say explains how land and the question of who owns land under what ownership regimes is linked to the so-called war on drugs. Because we can see, at least in Colombia, it's very well documented. In Mexico, a bit less so, but there's also grounds to say that during the war on drugs, there's processes of dispossession at the same time. And I would say this is where we see how these asymmetric economic relations come in, because when we don't understand this just as a local problem, but in relation to multiple scales of political action and of economic action, then we can see how, for example, the huge demand for specific commodities, for resources at the time, globally, has an impact on the ways in which people are able to hold on to their land and collect to collective titles, for example, in both Colombia and Mexico, and how this is linked to punitive policies against them. So, for example, in Colombia, we can document how collective titles were revoked in and to great numbers suddenly after this military offensive is pushed for or is starts. And in Mexico, similarly, we have expropriations of land in areas where people are also affected by military operations and suddenly see them. So activists would tell me, so now suddenly we are seeing the military close to our territory, for example. And at the same time, we have these mining corporations like knocking on our doors and saying that they need this area and so on. So these kind of things, we can see how they're linked. And it tells me that long-standing continuities has something to do with how people are affected by this and also who is able to shape these practices.
How then should we think about just enforcement and political coercion in general, or at least, you know, what does your study reveal to you about the nature of enforcement and political coercion?
Yeah, so I'm interested not only in who is particularly vulnerable to state and non-state coercion and to violence, as I just said, but also in who is really able to shape state policies in this respect, who holds influence over punitive practices, and who is able to push for these. So I start from a relational understanding of the state. So the idea that the actual asymmetrical relations within society are what forms the state, So the state is not separate from these, but permeated by power relations. And this tells us something about state coercion, namely that some in society have more possibility than others to influence this. It's not purely instrumental, obviously, and it's also not always like you are someone who has influence on the state and then you can always push for this. But it also tells us that not everyone is affected in the same way. Not everyone is able to influence this in the same way. So this is why I speak of selective security, to account also for how police and military forces in these contexts have routinely killed those that they constructed as criminals, lower class, and or racially inferior. So I think we can actually document a bias here. And it also somewhat explains how during a particular conjuncture in the early to mid-2000s, for example, Colombian paramilitaries were able to participate in shaping the judicial responses to the atrocities they themselves committed before. So, for example, they there's documentation, there's data, both interviews, but also archival documents and leaked documents that show us how paramilitaries were saying they were actually doing active lobbying on those laws, for example. So this is what I try to understand the state and coercion from these power relations.
You know, looking at the way in which the enforcement occurs, you also look at the, you know, just general economic activity, specifically illegal economic activity in the drug trade. So, you know, what have you seen about how the drug trade has proliferated and how have some of these kind of background, ways in which certain people have the upper hand in terms of political power impacted the proliferation of the drug trade?
Yeah, I would say something that helps us here or that helped me understand this a little better are some insights from anthropology and also economic geography. So Carolyn Nordstrom, for example, or Gregson and Krang's work on habitual illegality in global economy is sort of the idea that generally also the separation between legal and illegal economy is much less clear cut than we may often think, much more fluid. And neoliberalization, so for example, the abolishment of regulations in trade and finance, has enabled capital to flow much more freely. So what we can see, for example, in those two contexts in Mexico is that obviously sort of the Mexican debt crisis and the whole privatization process that came after in the 1980s already play a role here. But we can also see that during the 2000s, in relation to the NAFTA trade agreements from the 1990s onwards, we can see a certain liberalization of finance, and that helps in Colombia the same happened, and that actually helps illegal finance to flow into legal economy. So these interrelations become more intricate, let's say. And I would also say that there is, we can see structurally in these, so we can see some shifts in during these times that not only result from the commodity super cycle of the 2000s in some regions, so the new demand for land that I mentioned, but also growing social inequality in one of the already most unequal regions of the world. But that also advanced that wave of demand for investment opportunities. And so it didn't matter that much where the money came from, but investments were done. We can see that also with the influx of capital that wasn't clearly accounted for to Colombia. And in some cases, it's not the illegal economy, but it comes from fiscal paradises, for example, in the Caribbean, you know. But it's generally sort of, it's clear that there's less control about capital flows, and that does help illegal economy.
And for these state authorities in Mexico and Colombia that are trying to, you know, build up their reputations or build up their, you know, their claim to sovereignty in the fight against the cartels, you know, what are some ways that you've seen them seek to increase authority?
So taking up what I said before, I think they try to do that, or they try to present this increased authority through a combination of punitive policies, presence of state forces, and teaming up with some actors to combat others. But that, in fact, I would say that this produces insecurity for broad parts of society. So, for example, when we look at Colombia, then there is actually documentation about how in the 1990s, the national police would team up with the so-called PEPES to, for example, to capture Pablo Escobar. And this then fed into the power of later paramilitary groups, because it was these precise groups that the police had teamed up with that then later on formed the AUC, the self-defense forces, so-called self-defense forces. And so these kind of, or these efforts to combat certain groups, they are in some ways understandable, but they did not actually increase the security for broad sectors of society, right? And one thing that they tried to do was, in Colombia, in some ways also in Mexico, was to broaden the tasks of the military. For example, in Colombia, people would tell me, activists, for example, that I interviewed would tell me, so now you have, when, so for example, in municipalities that are very poor, that don't have sort of their own, don't have a lot of resources themselves through taxes, for example, they would have militaries that are serving as doctors, as teachers. All interior policy really converged in military strategies. And that meant that in the rehabilitation zones, for example, that I mentioned earlier, you would not have state presence in terms of schools or hospitals broadened, but rather just as the military, and then sometimes in connection with paramilitary groups.
And you know, there's obviously been people that protest this and or advocate for different, you know, they might not want the cartels there, but they also might want other things from their government. So, you know, what have you seen in terms of activists and critics of the government? How have they been received or silenced?
Yeah, so it depends a lot on who you talk to. So obviously, some of the activists I've spoken to, for example, from areas like Arauca in Colombia or Oaxaca in southern Mexico, have argued that people had been disappeared, forcibly disappeared, because of their activism, and sometimes by state actors, or state authorities were at least implicated in disappearances, if not the direct perpetrators. So their everyday experiences with the state sort of resembled war, but within a functioning democratic order, right? So we are still talking about democratic elections and, you know, a lot of formal mechanisms that are held up. when you talk to, for example, human rights lawyers, judges, journalists in Mexico City, for example, or in Bogota, then I was, for example, able to talk to one lawyer who said that they had been surveilled by the Secret Service in Colombia, and based on manuals aiming to where the Secret Service people talk about how they could boycott NGO work and see them as political targets. And this lawyer said it was incredible. They rented a flat opposite ours. They went through our garbage. We know they entered the house when we weren't home. And you would also say, now that we know the reports about this, we realize that many attacks on human rights lawyers coincide with details from those reports. So state institutions would use the information from these kind of illegal surveillance practices and use them against those people. But even within the state, so in Colombia, let's say again, conflicts arose between the Supreme Court and the executive when the Supreme Court started investigating politicians for their links with paramilitaries in the mid-2000s. And so the Secret Service, again, would set traps, and they would tell me that sort of the judges and people that I talked to would tell me that even the lady serving coffee in the Supreme Court was an infiltrated agent who would place recording devices under the tables or the judges' drivers. So it was persecution against the judges and their families in a way, which ultimately led to major conflict, right? In Mexico, I have spoken to people that were imprisoned and that would say that they were imprisoned on political grounds, really. There were others where there's documentation about police officers that have confessed kidnapping people on behalf of local criminals, let's say. So whatever their actual implication in those, in sort of in concrete cases, political figures in those governments played by the books of counterinsurgency practices and the prevention of dissent. And there were people that protested, and it's really interesting to see how in these adverse contexts, people would still try to transform the society. And so it isn't actually effective. People stop believing also the security discourse about how this would make their own security situation better and so on. So it's also very different from the case of El Salvador at the moment, where we can see people, when we can see these media reports about people that are really supporting these strategies, it seems. But it's definitely policies or practices that are also targeting activists quite clearly. And this is dynamic. Again, this sometimes is, well, during the time that I look at, it's much more than this can change. It's not like this is a static thing.
So when you look at the, you know, increasing security and, you know, militarization in response to the war on drugs, what are some of the other policies that typically go alongside these strategies?
So what I said before, I think this really plays a role in these two conjunctures that I look at, early 2000s in Colombia and mid to late 2000s in Mexico. One is the investment policies that, again, respond to this huge demand in global economy for certain products, particularly minerals, natural resources, and so on, which then leads to a new protagonism of certain actors also economically. So the Mexican Mining Chamber, for example, acquires a role that it didn't have in the years prior. There's also a strong emphasis on labor market flexibilization in Colombia, which hadn't taken place to that extent before. There's policies that produce or that create special economic zones in Colombia to attract, basically to attract foreign direct investment. And this is also something that doesn't despite this sense of insecurity that is transmitted also in the media and in transnational media and so on, despite this sense, foreign direct investment doesn't actually go down. And not if you look at it in different parts of these countries, it also doesn't go down in those countries, that in those areas that are most affected by violence. So in northern Mexico, in those years, around 2011, when there's a lot of talk about escalating homicide rates and so on, they still concentrate most of the foreign direct investment, just as an example. And then there's land policies, a deepening of the of possibilities for private ownership of land, sort of agrarian like policies for in industrial agrarian investments, possibilities to enlarge plantations and so on.
So, you know, from today's vantage point, you know, looking at the current political climate and then, you know, the history that you cover in the book, how do you sort of judge the respective wars on drugs taken? And, you know, have the expansions of the security states been effective at all?
So this is not going to come as a surprise. And I'm also not the only one saying this. And there's lots of great work that has come to similar conclusions. So it has not been effective in producing security for broader sectors of society. In fact, we can see that these kind of practices have rather meant a sense of broadened insecurity for a lot of people. It's not been effective in guaranteeing people security to exercise their social or political rights. Initiatives like Plan Colombia or the Merida Initiative that are part of the so-called war on drugs, where some U.S. Finances are used for security practices in those two contexts, they're also always presented as models of security cooperation by governments. But I would say that they were partly covering up links such as those that the ex-president Uribe had with paramilitaries, or the regional pacts in Colombia that were signed between paramilitary groups and regional politicians. So it's also not been effective in any way in severing these kind of ties with illegal groups of parts of state institutions. It's also not been effective in suppressing coca production, for example, in Colombia, because the demand was there. In fact, production kept growing until very recently, when it seems that global demand has shifted somewhat to synthetic drugs, and there's been some shift also of production regions towards other countries. And it's also not been effective in quelling competition between criminal groups that do exist, right? So the kingpin strategy of, which was part of the so-called war on drugs, where you would take out major figures of those criminal networks, be it through killing them or through putting them into prison, has basically really fueled those competitions. So even from that standpoint, it hasn't been effective. And I would say what we can see is that obviously things move on, and we have in Colombia, we have seen major political shifts. So Petro, who is now the president, Gustavo Petro, he was among those first people that had accused the Uribe government in 2005, 2006 of paramilitary links. So he was a very important figure in doing that. And the fact that he is now the president does tell us something about at least a political will to change these kind of practices. But they haven't been completely successful in turning things around and turning the situation around. And this has not happened in Mexico, despite the political shifts, right? So in 2018, we've had Andrés Manuel López Obrador assuming office, and with the promise to change security practices in Mexico, but it has not actually materialized, what has been effective here is really the protagonism of the military. And this has been consolidated. Now more than ever, it seems that in Mexico, the militaries and the Marines have a major role to play, as in their presence in different regions, but also as owners of infrastructure, deciding or participating in the decisions about their own budget and so on. So in terms of citizenship rights or in terms of political agency of different people or of allowing these kind of different people to participate in politics, this is not what this strategy has produced.
You've mentioned El Salvador a couple of times, and I think it's you know important to bring El Salvador up because they've kind of gone and taken the most extreme militarization and you know imprisonment strategy. I think they've just looking at it in the past couple of years, they've arrested, it seems like, upwards of 70,000 people without clear due process and trials, essentially rounding people up based on you know variety of superficial or unclear reasons. And Bukele, the president, was just reelected. What do you see with this strategy? And could you see that what El Salvador is doing being replicated in Mexico and Colombia and other places like Ecuador too?
So first of all, it's not a new strategy. Bukele has not invented this. He has been, it seems, quite apt in presenting it as his new idea or something like that. But it is very ambiguous because it seems that some people in El Salvador are feeling that their security situation has actually improved. But it obviously also means a lot of insecurity for others who have been unjustly imprisoned. And there, it reminds me a lot of practices in Colombia, where then President Uribe was saying, so we need a mass arrest of 200 people at a time, because otherwise we won't be able to suppress these criminal groups, which is obviously, this is not going to mean due process or anything for the people that are then detained, right? And there's lots of harrowing stories about these imprisonments without any justification, really. So, and this is the case for El Salvador as well. And also the contexts are very different, right? The size of the countries, the social relations are different. So I wouldn't be able to really compare those or to sort of think of how would this exactly be replicated. I don't think that a purely military or purely punitive strategy can be successful in the long term either. It's a short-term strategy at best.
Yeah, no, of course, it can be very hard to compare. And I think that that's, I appreciate that too, because sometimes people will draw analogies in too far ways. But yeah, certainly it seems like that the strategy, if it effective in the short term, will clearly run into long-term issues, you know, specifically around how do you actually then go about giving people fair trials when there isn't necessarily resources present to do something like that.
Yeah, it has impacts on democratic political practices as well. It's quite clear.
I was wondering, you know, with this study and with this project, if there's you know, anything else that you're looking at now to kind of continue this study that you're doing, any other lines and threads that are intriguing to you?
Yeah, I mean, I've shifted this work a little bit towards the urban realm, looking at specific cities and the ways in which specifically austerity policies that are requested of municipalities interlink with the security situation and how people navigate this. So I've got a few more recent articles also out with on that, how people are able in these contexts to become politically active through the concrete example of Oaxaca, for example, in Mexico. But I'm also currently working on a project where I look at the political practices around large-scale infrastructures and The link with the so-called war on drugs is not as direct and not as apparent. But given that a lot of these infrastructures, I particularly look at energy infrastructures, the ways in which these have been discursively linked to security topics. So these infrastructures have to be secured, and they're also part of our energy security and so on. So at least through discourse, they are connected. And we can also see how they are presented by different governments as filters for migration. So infrastructure projects supposedly serve as sort of siphoning of people from going further north. And so I'm looking at these kind of discourses and also the actual practices around these infrastructures, and sort of the security topic comes up once and again. Hard to not come across it.
Well, Olga, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. The book is Selective Security and the War on Drugs, The Coloniality of State Power in Colombia and Mexico. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thanks everyone for listening in.